Read beginning in verse 1. And Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, that the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back, with her two sons, of whom the name of one was Gershom. For he said, I have been a stranger in a foreign land. And the name of the other was Eliezer. For he said, the God of my father was my help, and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness, where he was encamped at the mountain of God. Now he had said to Moses, I, your father-in-law, Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons with her. So Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, bowed down and kissed him. And they asked each other about their well-being, and they went into the tent. And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had come upon them on the way, and how the Lord had delivered them. Then Jethro rejoiced for all the good which the Lord had done for Israel, whom he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Jethro said, Blessed be the Lord, who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, and who has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods, for in the very thing in which they behaved proudly, he was above them. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and other sacrifices to offer to God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. And so it was on the next day that Moses sat to judge the people. And the people stood before Moses from morning until evening. So when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did for the people, he said, What is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit? And all the people stand before you from morning until evening. And Moses said to his father-in-law, Because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a difficulty, they come to me, and I judge between one and another, and I make known the statutes of God and his laws. So Moses' father-in-law said to him, The thing that you do is not good. Both you and these people who are with you will surely wear yourselves out. For this thing is too much for you. You are not able to perform it by yourself. Listen now to my voice. I will give you counsel, and God will be with you. Stand before God for the people, so that you may bring the difficulties to God. And you shall teach them the statutes and the laws, and show them the way in which they must walk and the work they must do. Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. And let them judge the people at all times. Then it will be that every great matter they shall bring to you, but every small matter they themselves shall judge. So it will be easier for you, for they will bear the burden with you. If you do this thing, and God so commands you, then you will be able to endure, and all this people will also go to their place in peace. So Moses heeded the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he had said. And Moses chose able men out of all Israel, and made them heads over the people, rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. So they judged the people at all times. The hard cases they brought to Moses, but they judged every small case themselves. Then Moses let his father-in-law depart, and he went his way to his own land. Amen. Well, if you notice specifically at verse 4, they have arrived at Mount Sinai. That will be developed further in chapter 19 as there is preparation for the giving of the law in chapter 20. So they've been wandering now for about 3 months. They left Egypt, and now they've arrived at their destination at Sinai, where God had told them he would bring them in chapter 3 at verse 12. But prior to the giving of the law, we see this emphasis on the delegation of judicial authority by Moses to men that would be able to assist him in the government of the children of Israel. Some have placed this later or say that this occurred later after the giving of the law because Moses here is mediating the laws and the statutes of God. I don't think we need to read it that way. I think that God had already been communicating through Moses to the children of Israel certain statutes, commandments, and laws, but it's codified or given at the Decalogue in chapter 20, and then it's developed in terms of its application to Israel for their life in the land in chapters 21 to 23. So when we look at this particular chapter, there's two broad strokes we need to observe. In the first place, the conversion of Jethro in verses 1 to 12, and then secondly, the counsel of Jethro in verses 13 to 27. There's probably a lot of ways that people read chapter 18 in terms of Jethro, who was or identified here as a priest of Midian. Did he already know Yahweh before? Was he a priest to Yahweh of Midian? I don't think so. I think this is the time when he comes to embrace the living and the true God as a result of the testimony of Moses, his son-in-law, having been given to him. So let's look first at the conversion of Jethro, verses 1 to 12. There's two things here, the reunion with Jethro in verses 1 to 7, and then the conversion of Jethro in verses 8 to 12. But notice with reference to the reunion in verses 1 to 7, there is a marked contrast between chapter 17 and chapter 18. This is just one of those sort of interesting places where we see the literary genius of the Bible. So you have this victory over the Amalekites in chapter 17 at verses 8 to 16. And then here in chapter 18, you have a contrast. So the encounter with the Amalekites is focused on war. You see that in 17:8 and 17:16. And the encounter with Jethro is about peace, the well-being of Jethro and Moses in verse 7, and then the well-being of all Israel in verse 23. In chapter 17, Moses has Joshua choose men for war against the Amalekites in 17:9. And here Moses selects men to function in the judiciary. In chapter 17, Moses sits on a stone during the battle, and here in chapter 18, he sits in judgment. In chapter 17, his hands are weary with reference to the battle, and here he is weary while he's engaged in judicial matters. So again, the literary genius of the Bible, seeing these contrasts, seeing these overlaps, seeing thematic reference throughout as we move through Scripture. Now, in terms of the background with reference to Jethro, the priest of Midian, we first meet him back in chapter 2. In chapter 2, at verses 16 to 22, remember, Moses is kind to Jethro's daughters, and then they bring him back to this man, Jethro. And so, of course, when you look at verse 18 in chapter 2, Reuel refers to Jethro as well. Most likely, it's a clan name. It's not that he's Jethro Reuel or Reuel Jethro. He's probably Jethro of the clan of Reuel. So we meet Jethro back then in conjunction with Zipporah. Now, when we come back to chapter 18, we see that Jethro is bringing Zipporah and the two sons back to Moses. So why were they not present with him? Why did Moses leave Zipporah and his two sons with Jethro? Well, Gill says the plain case seems to be, and again, there's a lot of ink spilled. Some suggest that Moses and Zipporah divorced, and there's just a whole lot of things concerning this. But I think Gill nails it. He says the plain case seems to be that Moses finding his family would be exposed to danger or would be too great an encumbrance upon him in the discharge of his great work which he had to do in Egypt, sent them back to his father-in-law until a fit opportunity should offer of their coming to him as now did. I think that makes good sense. Calvin seems to disregard that interpretation because there was a lot of other wives that were with their husbands in the midst of the Exodus. But I would argue they weren't doing what Moses was doing. Moses was going face to face with Pharaoh, so I don't think it would have been unwise for him to leave his wife and his two sons with Jethro for that time being. Now, with reference to the reunion proper, notice in verse 1, we see that Jethro had heard what God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, that the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. So again, I'm going to argue that he's converted in this because he's heard the testimony, he's seen the power, he has witnessed that God of Israel is in fact the true and living God, so he comes out of darkness into marvelous light. It's similar to Rahab. Rahab the harlot confesses the same sorts of things with reference to the spies from Israel. She knew and had heard what God had done, and understanding this great power of the living and true God, essentially in that paganistic sort of polytheistic land, when you saw this supreme God best all of the other would-be gods, it would definitely testify concerning his power and his glory. As well, he sends back Zipporah and Moses' two sons. The text rehearses what the names are. Gershom, for he said, I have been a stranger in a foreign land. Verse 4, the name of the other was Eleazar, for he said, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. So not only does Jethro send them back to Moses, and again, Jethro knows the mountain of God. He knows this land of Sinai. We already see him there in chapter 3, and there it's announced that God would bring his children to this place of Sinai. So he meets back with him. And then in verse 6, I don't think this is the formal meeting. That's in verse 7, but he probably sends word ahead to mention to Moses that he's en route. So verse 5 tells us he was encamped at the mountain of God. Again, that's Sinai, also referred to as Horeb. When you see Horeb, that's another name for Sinai. Now verse 6 says, he had said to Moses, I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons with her. Again, it was probably by a runner, by a messenger, to alert Moses to the fact that his wife and his sons were coming. Now the formal greeting comes in verse 7, the meeting between Jethro and Moses. Notice, Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, bowed down, kissed him, and they asked each other about their well-being, and they went into the tent. Now notice, the testimony of Moses that he gives to Jethro, and then Jethro's response to that testimony. Moses told of what God had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians. Notice in verse 8a, and Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord, that's Yahweh, it's the God of Israel. And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake. That probably meant he rehearsed the 10 plagues, culminating in the 10th plague, where God had killed the firstborn throughout Egypt. And then how Pharaoh and his armies gave chase, and then God brought his children through the Red Sea, the division of the waters, and then brought those waters to bear upon Pharaoh's army. So he rehearsed the powerful works of God. So verse 8a underscores one of the grand themes throughout the book of Exodus. God announces to Moses at several places, Paul picks this up in Romans chapter 9, that the purpose for which God raised up Pharaoh was that God was able to display his glory and his power throughout the earth, that everybody would know that there was in fact a God in Israel. But intriguingly, notice what else Moses goes on with in his testimony. Moses would not have truck with the health, wealth, and prosperity gospel. Notice what he says at 8b. He says, all the hardship that had come upon them on the way and how the Lord had delivered them. Never quite understood this approach to preaching the gospel by telling people that not only are your sins forgiven, but your cupboards will always be stocked, your closets will always be loaded down, and your bank account will never be wanting. Why would we do that? First of all, it's a lie. Second of all, one of the blessings of the service of God Most High is the reality that though we still face affliction and hardship and difficulty, he nevertheless sees us through it. So as Moses testifies, he doesn't gloss over the hard parts of the journeying of the children of Israel. He doesn't say, yes, once we left Egypt, they loaded us with all this money, we stepped foot into the promised land, and there we enjoyed the milk and the honey. No, we stopped at places where there was no food. We stopped at places where there was no water. We stopped at places where there were angry Amalekites. We stopped at places where there were persons that wanted to decimate us and destroy us, but the Lord delivered us out of them all, out of all of the hardships. David sees this as well in his own life. Two places he bookends this particular statement. in 2 Samuel 4 at verse 9. David says, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all adversity." And then in 1 Kings, at the end of his life, even after the Uriah incident, even after the Bathsheba incident, David is able to say at the end of his life, in 1 Kings 1:29, that as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from every distress. And certainly the New Testament is replete with this emphasis. All who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution, but God delivers them from it all. John 16:33, Jesus said, "In this world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer, for I have overcome the world." The very book of Revelation starts off with the churches in Asia Minor in chapters 2 and 3, underscoring the great suffering and affliction that the people of God face on the earth. And then the scene shifts to the throne room of heaven in chapters 4 and 5 to see Yahweh's response to the mutiny of man on the face of the earth. So this idea that we only ever portray God as rosy and as a Disney movie is simply not accurate. Moses doesn't shrink back from declaring the whole counsel of God, including not only the good times, God's deliverance of us from the land of Egypt, but also the hardships that we face. The Lord delivered us from them all. Now notice how Jethro responds. He first responds with joy over God's deliverance. Again, all these things are characteristic of somebody who's come out of darkness into marvelous light. There is that joy inexpressible and full of glory. Verse 9, "Then Jethro rejoiced for all the good which the Lord had done for Israel, whom he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians." There was that understanding, that recognition of the power of God, not only in the devastation of the enemies of God, but in the preservation of his people through their hardship and affliction. Notice in verse 10, he gives praise to God for his deliverance. Verse 10, "And Jethro said, blessed be," again, Yahweh. This man was most likely polytheistic. This man was most likely a man who subscribed to a plurality of gods. Now he comes to bless, to speak well, to praise the name of the living and the true God. "Blessed be Yahweh, who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, and who has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians." Again, this is typical of those who come out of darkness into marvelous light. Notice thirdly, he confesses the supremacy of God Most High. Again, he's not confessing the way that somebody would in our baptistry, but he is confessing consistent with the light that was available to him at that particular time. Notice in verse 11, "Now I know that Yahweh is greater than all the gods, for in the very thing in which they behaved proudly, he was above them." And the pride, obviously, was in the fact that they cast the firstborn children into the Nile River in order to drown them. Well, how did they meet their end? How did they meet their devise under the power of Yahweh? It was through death by drowning. So it was an application of the lex talionis, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life, in the same manner in which they had persecuted the children of God. So he confesses the supremacy of Yahweh, and then what does he do in verse 12? He worships. So everything consistent with a new covenant conversion. There's joy in the hearts of God's people. There's praise expressed to God himself. There is a confession of his supremacy. And then there is worship of God in verse 12. Notice, "Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and other sacrifices to offer to God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God." Now, the actual giving of the sacrificial system comes later in redemptive history. We know that. We're reading the book of Leviticus, and I'm trying to explain how the book of Leviticus solves the tension created at the end of chapter 40 in the book of Exodus. But why does he do what he does? Because this was already present in redemptive history. God killed animals and clothed Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 3 at verse 21. In Genesis chapter 4, verses 3 to 5, at the end of the days, we see Cain and Abel go to offer sacrifice to the Lord. Of course, Abel brings blood atonement. Genesis chapter 22, we have Abraham called by God to go to Mount Moriah with Isaac and to offer up his son, his only son, the son whom he loves. And he's supposed to do that by blood atonement. Now, of course, the angel of Yahweh stops his hand. He doesn't do it, but there is this ram caught in the thicket so that they would learn that we get forgiveness or remission or atonement by the death of another. In fact, Stuart makes this observation. They all knew something about sacrificing as the heart of obedient worship, since that concept had trickled down into the consciousness of peoples all over the earth from the days of the first family, who understood the basic concept of sacrifice. Something else must die so that I may live. Don't underestimate that. Genesis 3:21 was a powerful moment in redemptive history. On the heels of the first messianic promise in Genesis 3:15, then comes blood atonement by God himself to provide for or provide a covering for Adam and Eve. And then again, Abel brings those first fruits of the animals to sacrifice before Yahweh, and then that incident with reference to Abraham. So we see Jethro converted by God's grace. He goes from a priest of Midian, hopefully to a priest of Yahweh back in Midian, but he becomes one who testifies concerning the grace of God Most High. Now, it doesn't stop there because Jethro has some good counsel or some good advice from Moses. And Moses is the man that is described to us in the Pentateuch. He was a humble man. While he had the highest particular office in Israel at the time, he was not against listening to the counsel of wise people. And that's precisely what we have in the later half of the chapter. So there's two things to observe here. First, the judicial function of Moses in verses 13 to 16, and then the recommendation of Jethro in verses 19 to 27. Now, when you move on in the Pentateuch, there is detailed legislation given with reference to the law courts. You've got the information in Deuteronomy 16 in terms of lower courts or judges and officers at the local level. And then later in chapter 17, you have instructions for a high court. For something that could not be adjudicated in a lower court, then there was a higher court that was in Israel that would hear those particular cases. As well, in both Deuteronomy 17 and then in 19, you have laws concerning witnesses. In other words, there is an emphasis in a civilized society governed by God's law on due process. And that ought to be one of the things that most concerns us in North America presently, is to see the erosion of due process, to see what appears to be two tiers with reference to civil justice, where some people are penalized because of political unorthodoxy in the eyes of others, and others seem to skate unscathed based on their politics. Well, in a civil society with a judiciary, it's supposed to function in a properly and orderly way, and that's what we have in the Pentateuch. Now, notice the practice of Moses in verse 13. And so it was on the next day that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood before Moses from morning until evening. What's the presupposition here? The presupposition is total depravity. The presupposition is sin. The presupposition is that there will be interpersonal. That means among people, whether they're God's people or they're pagans, whether it's a mix of God's people and pagans, whether it's all believers or all unbelievers or an admixture of both. There will always be interpersonal friction, tension, disputes, or problems due to the doctrine of total depravity. That is inescapable. It is unavoidable. Notice as well the presence of such tension, dispute, problem, and difficulty, even when the corporate body has the common goal in mind. In other words, they were on mission. We like to say that in the church today. We're on mission. Well, they were on mission. They left the land of Egypt. They were delivered by the power of Yahweh, and they were heading to the promised land. If you would think there was ever a time when a people could get along and not need to bother Moses with their disputes and issues, that would have been it. But no, Moses needed to adjudicate because of total depravity and because of the tension that obtains between men in sin. And the reality or the presence of sin demands a mechanism to redress that problem. And again, we see the wisdom of God at this early juncture to provide that mechanism. So it's not the case that we'll ever have a situation where there's no sin or no crime. What is necessary is that we have a mechanism that is founded upon God's law that is able to deal with that and to redress the issues that are faced by men in sin. So this is the presupposition in the section. Notice, though, with reference to verse 13, how grand a task it was. And so it was on the next day that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood before Moses, notice, from morning until evening. So when you have a lot of people, you have even more friction. When you have a lot of people, you have even more dispute. When you have a lot of people, you have even more tension. And so this is what Moses has given himself to at this particular juncture. So notice, if that's what Moses is occupied with from morning until evening, guess what Moses isn't occupied with? Other issues concerning administration, other issues concerning leadership, other issues concerning getting this people from point A to point B in one, intact. Now notice in verse 14, Moses continues, or rather Jethro now asks a question. Verse 14, so when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did for the people, he said, "What is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit and all the people stand before you from morning until evening?" Now his concern is not that Moses was doing it. His concern is that Moses alone was doing it. It was too much. Even a man of the caliber of Moses is a man at best. It's been well said, the best of men are men at best. And the best of men have their limitations. They have their inabilities. They have their weariness. And that's what's in sharp relief in this particular section. And Jethro gives him good counsel. Now notice Moses' response in verses 15 and 16. He says that the people come to Moses to inquire of God. So verse 15, Moses said to his father-in-law, "Because the people come to me to inquire of God." Stewart explains, the legal process involved the revelatory process in this case. In other words, they're coming to hear from God, not Moses primarily. He says that was almost certainly the reason Moses had felt obligated to do all the judging himself. The answers involved God's own decisions, and Moses understood himself to be the sole conduit for those to the people. In other words, Moses had a good heart. Moses had a great desire. Moses understood the difficulties involved with the people of Israel and that they needed the word of Yahweh to come to adjudicate their particular tensions or disputes or their friction. So Moses had good reason for doing this. But before we move on, one other point that I think verse 15calls attention to. Moses said to his father-in-law, "Because the people come to me to inquire of God." Okay, so revelatory in nature. So God speaks through Moses to these people. But there is a principle here that I think John Calvin nails. John Calvin says, he says that disputants come to inquire of God, and that he makes them to know the statutes of God and his laws. Hence it follows that this is the object of political government, that God's tribunal should be erected on earth, wherein he may exercise the judge's office, to the end that judges and magistrates should not arrogate to themselves to decide anything arbitrarily or wantonly, nor, in a word, to assume to themselves what belongs to God. Then and then only will magistrates acquit themselves properly when they remember that they are the representatives of God. So in other words, they're not there to be despots. They're not there to be tyrants. They're not there to be oppressors. They are there to ensure the safety and protection of the body politic. They are there as God's representative. Romans chapter 13, let every soul be subject to the governing authority, for there is no authority except from God. So if God raises up the authority and God establishes the authority, that authority is ultimately responsible to the people over that he's over, but as well to God ultimately. In other words, he's not a law unto himself. He is not a renegade. He is not to function the way that Pharaoh functioned in Egypt. So the people come to Moses to inquire of God, and then the practice of Moses was to reveal the mind of God. Notice in verse 16, when they have a difficulty, they come to me, and I judge between one and another, and I make known the statutes of God and his laws. Again, that's what you want. That was to be the function of the judiciary and of the legislative branch in Israel's government. Now notice the recommendation of Jethro. In the first place, he gives some general advice, verses 17 to 20. Notice the fact that the arrangement was not good for Moses or the people. See, if one man tries to do it all, it's not only detrimental to his own health and well-being, but ultimately the body politic suffers also. Notice what he says in verse 17. So Moses' father-in-law said to him, "The thing that you do is not good." Again, not that he's giving the revelation of God. He's not saying that. He's saying that you're doing it from morning till evening all by yourself. That's not good. He says, both you and these people who are with you will surely wear yourselves out. For this thing is too much for you. You are not able to perform it by yourself. What's the implication? Some of those who had been there from morning until evening, some of those who were being worn out, perhaps were not getting their fair hearing as well. So it was detrimental not only for Moses' health and well-being, but also for the people that needed faithful adjudication. So verse 13, from morning until evening. Verse 18, both you and these people who are with you will surely wear yourselves out. You are not able to perform it by yourself. So most likely some persons were being overlooked. Stewart, I think, again, helpfully comments. In effect, Jethro's argument is an early version of the now popular legal saying, justice delayed is justice denied. So what happens? It's not just taxing upon Moses, it is as well taxing upon the people who aren't getting their day in court, who aren't getting the full hearing and the ability for one man trying to oversee all of these, you know, thousands and thousands of people with all of their disputes. He wasn't able to perform it. So what he does here in terms of recommendation is very good. Notice in verse 20, or verse 19 rather, listen now to my voice. I will give you counsel and God will be with you. Stand before God. And now, brethren, there are people that say Moses shouldn't have listened to this pagan priest. Moses should not have listened to Jethro. But listen, Jethro's converted now. But Jethro, having dealt most likely with the same sorts of situations, functioning as a priest in Midian, would have learned some good horse sense along the way. But you also need to understand that Jethro is not arrogating to himself the position of God. Notice what he says in verse 23. If you do this thing and God so commands you. Jethro lays this advice at the feet of Moses, knowing that Moses is the type of fellow that's going to pray to Yahweh, that's going to inquire of Yahweh. If Moses would inquire of Yahweh for a dispute affecting Israelites that had a particular issue that Moses was adjudicating, don't we think that Moses would inquire of Yahweh with reference to this advice from Jethro as to whether or not he should delegate judicial authority? I would argue most certainly he would have, and he did. He doesn't do this based on the testimony of a pagan priest. He does this in light of good counsel, good advice given from now a Yahweh worshiper who nevertheless, in his background as pagan priest, learned some things about the world from the light of revelation, the general light of nature. There are laws and truths that we witness and see in the created order around us. So Moses is not to be faulted for listening to a pagan. Moses functions on behalf of God, and I would submit that he would have inquired of the Lord in order to adopt this particular advice. So back to verse 19. Listen now to my voice. I will give you counsel, and God will be with you. Stand before God for the people, so that you may bring the difficulties to God. And you shall teach them the statutes and the laws, and show them the way in which they must walk and the work which they must do. What could possibly be wrong with this counsel? This is great counsel. Stand before God for the people, so that you may bring the difficulties to God. And then you shall teach them the statutes and the laws, and show them the way in which they must walk and the work they must do. In other words, he is basically confirming or validating all that Moses has already been doing. This is what Moses' own report was. This is what I do. They inquire of me. I go to the Lord. I get the ruling from God, and I bring it back. Now, verses 21 and following, he says you need to delegate. There needs to be a division of labor. One man cannot do this all. You're going to kill yourself, and you're going to gyp the people, and they're not going to be able to receive the judgments that they desire or they need. Now notice, in terms of the specific counsel in verses 21 to 23. In the first place, Moses is to select men. Verse 21, moreover, you shall select from all the people. You shall select from all the people. Calvin, on this passage, says, thou shalt provide, meaning thou shalt choose out and take the most worthy, so that such an office be not entrusted rashly to any on that offers, anyone that offers. But this was most reasonable among a free people, that the judges should not be chosen for their wealth or rank, but for their superiority in virtue. Now notice, he gives four specific qualifications. We're all sort of savvy with this idea of qualifications for church eldership because we've been working our way through 1 Timothy 3, 1 to 7 on Sunday night. Well, there was a necessity for qualified men in the judiciary at the time of Moses. It wasn't just by wealth or status. You weren't born into this, but rather you were selected from the people because you had evidenced a worthiness to function in this particular capacity. Notice, in the first place, they must be able men. I don't know what it is about humans. We have a knack for picking the most unable men and giving them as much possible power as we can invest in them. It is truly amazing that we have such a knack for this. Let's find the most miserable, the most corrupt, the most deceptive, the most duplicitous, and let's put them in the highest office in our land. If people don't wake up and start to see the reality that these leaders are taking our country down into the sewage pit, we better get our minds in order as to what kind of men we ought to be selecting for high office. So they must be able men. Listen to Matthew Poole's comment here. Able men, literally in the Hebrew, men of might. Excuse me for a moment. Men of might. Not for strength of body, but for greatness, resolution, courage, and constancy of mind, which is the best preservative against partiality and corruption in judgment, to which men of little minds or narrow souls are easily swayed by fears or hopes or gifts. See, brethren, we always pick the latter. We always pick the ones he describes at the end. Those men of little minds or narrow souls that are easily swayed by fears or hopes or gifts. We need men of might that are great, resolute, have courage and constancy of mind. And then he says, which is the best preservative against what? Partiality and corruption in judgment. I mean, the case that we had in March of 2021... I don't care if every judge in Canada despises the church. Rule according to the law. That's the job, right? The Charter of Rights and Freedoms provides for us security to worship our God freely. You may hate that as a judge. You may despise that. You may be against that in terms of your religious commitment. But do the job that has been entrusted to you. This is why Lady Justice is blind. This is why Lady Justice has a blindfold on. It shouldn't depend on if the person is rich. Neither should it depend upon the person that's poor. The law of God prohibits partiality toward the poor man as well. The judge isn't supposed to feel pity and compassion because the defendant is poor. The guy is poor, so we're going to cut him some slack. No, if he's guilty, throw the book at him. If he's innocent, let him go free. Shouldn't matter if he's rich. Shouldn't matter if he's poor. You should have blindfold on and you should rule accordingly. That is descriptive of Messiah too in Isaiah 11. That was a part of the messianic expectation was that Messiah could potentially be blind. Because in Isaiah 11, it describes him thus, underscoring the reality that he doesn't judge according to the eyesight. He doesn't judge according to poverty or to riches. He doesn't judge according to anything in which he would be partial. He judges according to the law. So they must be able men. Secondly, they must be men who fear God. They must be men who fear God. Imagine that. God establishing civil polity in Israel demands that the people who function on his behalf fear him because they are prosecuting and executing and implementing his law. If they don't fear him, then they are not qualified to function in his behalf. Notice as well, they must be men of not lies, not deceit, not two-facedness. They must be men of truth. In the final analysis, brethren, that's what is requisite in our civil leaders, whether they be in the judiciary, whether they be in the legislative or the executive branch. We need men that are committed to the truth. And then the last one should be patently obvious, hating covetousness. Why? Because you shouldn't be able to buy off a judge. You shouldn't be able to have some great sort of a contract behind the scenes where he's going to get his beak wet insofar as he renders a verdict that is sympathetic to the persons that are wetting his beak. More often than not, follow the money to see the corruption that obtains with reference to our political class. They must hate covetousness. And again, notice when we jump into the new covenant, what is something that is replete in terms of emphasis for both elders and deacons? They must not have a love for money. That doesn't mean they live in huts. That doesn't mean they have no shoes. That doesn't mean they eat gruel when everyone around them is eating great food. But rather it means that though they see it as a tool and though it is necessary in order to live, that's not what motivates them. That's not what drives them. That's not what makes them tick. It isn't the desire to get their beaks wet that they pursue a life of religious leadership. So with reference to these qualifications, they must be able men, they must be men who fear God, they must be men of truth, and they must be men who hate covetousness. Poole comments here. Hating covetousness. This, though included in the former, is particularly expressed because gifts and bribes are the great corruptors of judges and judgments. This was known back then, too. And so there were safeguards put in place to try and avoid these sorts of things where you have corrupt men on benches or we have corrupt men in the legislative branch that are seeking to fill their own pockets at the sacrifice of the people they're supposed to govern and rule over. So they were to select, or Moses was to select men, and then notice secondly the function of men. Verse 22, let them judge the people at all times. Then it will be that every great matter they shall bring to you, but every small matter they themselves shall judge. So it will be easier for you, for they will bear the burden with you. Again, an establishment of a lower court system and a Supreme Court. Moses would function as the Supreme Court at this stage in Israel's history. And there were checks and balances. There were able and capable men under Moses to deal with the things that didn't need Moses' direct attention. This is beautiful. It's the division of labor. It's delegation for the obvious reasons to not exasperate or to frustrate or tax or kill one individual man, and also not to frustrate the multitude that perhaps are dependent on that one individual man. And then notice the relief that is afforded in verse 23. If you do this thing, and again, and God so commands you. He doesn't say, Moses, thou must do this. Moses, I'm giving you this information. I'm giving you this recommendation. I'm giving you this advice. I'm giving you this counsel that will help you and it will help the people. And if God so commands, there's going to be practical benefit. Notice, then you will be able to endure. In other words, it's not the case, Moses, that you should kill yourself before we even begin the proceedings at Sinai. We're not even near the promised land at this point, and you're burning yourself out to the point where you're going to drop dead. So there's going to be remedial benefit for you with this lower court system, but then notice that the people will prosper. Then you will be able to endure, and all this people will also go to their place in peace. So it's remedial, not only for Moses, but for the people that perhaps had not been heard. Now there's various courts or various men that give adjudication to various types of cases. The big matters, the great matters, the lofty matters, they still have access to Moses. They can still come to him for redress for their particular issues. So Jethro's not speaking in an authoritative way. He's not saying, I'm a superior pagan, Moses. I want you to... No, that's not it at all. He's giving him good counsel. Now notice the implementation of this or compliance of this by Moses in verses 24 to 27. So Moses heeded the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he had said. And Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. Now, the commentaries typically say that's similar to what you have in terms of management or leadership in the military. They say it shouldn't be pressed to the point where every 10 persons had their own judge. It's just the way that society is divvied up, the idea being, again, division of labor. There are men that will be over groups of people such that they have access to be able to deal with their particular disputes. And then notice, and again, we know that this was God-sanctioned advice when we move through the Pentateuch, because this is how Israel functioned. They had representatives who functioned as judges at the local level, and those matters that could not be redressed at the local level, they had a superior or a higher court. And that's how Israel functioned in terms of that system. Verse 25, Moses chose able men out of all Israel. He listened to the qualifications and he applied the qualifications. It doesn't say, so Moses chose his buddies. Moses chose the rich guys. Moses chose the guys that he could make backroom deals with, and you know they could all line their pockets at the expense of the children of Israel. No, he chose able men, men who feared God, men of truth, and men who were not, or men who hated covetousness. And then in verse 26, so they judged the people at all times. The hard cases they brought to Moses, but they judged every small case themselves. Then Moses let his father-in-law depart, and he went his way to his own land. So everything that we have in this passage speaks well concerning Jethro. He's not some renegade pagan that Moses gets captured by and, you know, is intoxicated with his pagan wisdom. No, this was of God, sanctioned by Yahweh, and it certainly helped Moses to sustain his own being, and it certainly helped the body politic to get verdicts with reference to their particular cases. So just a few thoughts before we close. First, again, the presence of interpersonal problems. It's going to happen. It's just, we got to deal with it. And God, in his grace, affords us a mechanism by which to deal with it. I remember several years ago, some of you know Pastor Mike Crawford. He used to come and visit here. He's now in Baltimore. But I remember when he took a trip to Haiti, kind of a missions trip. And you know Haiti, it's not the most wealthy country on the face of the earth. Very impoverished, very, very poor. And so when Pastor Crawford was with the pastors that were hosting him, Mike said, what should I preach on? You know, it's a kind of an interesting situation, a lot of poverty. They said, preach against sexual sin. And Mike's like, really? Oh, yeah, poor people like to fornicate too. It's the same thing. Wherever you are, whether you're on mission, whether you're poor, whether you're rich, whether you're all going the same way or not, there's going to be problems. There's going to be tension. There's going to be friction. But God has instilled mechanisms, both in the Old Covenant and in the New Covenant, for us to deal with that. In the New Covenant, with reference to church discipline issues, guess what? There's a chapter devoted to that. The rest of the New Testament comments on that. It's not that we just pretend that there's no sin. It's not that we just pretend that there's no dispute. It's not that we just hope it all goes away, but we deal with it the way that God has said. So there's an inevitability of these problems due to total depravity, inevitability even when we are engaged in the larger project. You'd think, again, marching to the promised land, we could all learn to get along, but they didn't, and they needed adjudication. And then the inevitability even among believers with remaining corruption. This idea that people have it, I can't believe my brother would sin against me that way. Really? You can't believe that? Do you read your Bible? Do you know anything about your heart? Do you have witnessed any of your own conduct in the way that you treat other people? This affront when anybody ever dares to sin against us. That is just a bizarre reaction in the church. Now, obviously, if the guy cuts you with a knife or something, there's cause for concern there. But this idea that people, you know, they sinned against me. Yeah, get used to it. That's life in this particular world. Secondly, the wisdom of God in the act of delegation. If you learn one thing from this passage, learn that no one man can do everything, which you all know already, and that when one man is entrusted with everything, then sometimes certain things fall by the wayside, whether by design or by accident. So the implementation by Moses means that he inquired of the Lord, and the Lord endorsed this recommendation or advice given by Jethro. And then the implementation by Moses brought the needed relief to him and relief for all the people. It was good for Moses. It was good for the people. Verse 23, then you will be able to endure, and all this people will also go to their place in peace. Not that, you know, harmony without sin, but their case had been solved. Their issue had been handled. They had gotten closure. Closure is important for people, and closure is an important aspect in our lives when we deal with disputes and hardships. And then the qualifications for these men. We need to think in terms of qualifications, yes, for ecclesiastical leaders, but also for civil authority. It ought not to be the case that we pick the most incapable, we pick the most liars, we pick the most covetous, and we pick the most wretched among us to function in the highest capacity over us. We need to think and pray in terms of responsible citizens in the civil kingdom. Christ is over the church. Christ is over the state. We happen to be members of the spiritual kingdom because of regeneration, because of grace, because of mercy. But we're also citizens of this body politic. And we should function in a responsible manner. Pietism or Quakerism or withdrawalism isn't the biblical norm. We find ourselves in this world. We live in a country where we have certain rights and responsibilities, and we as God's people should exercise them judiciously. And then finally, the grace of God in the conversion of Jethro. Who'd have thunk, as far as Jethro was concerned, that he would be confessing the supremacy of Yahweh of Israel? God takes a priest of Midian, calls him out of that darkness into marvelous light, and then uses him to instruct his leader, Moses, in a better or more excellent way in how to lead the people of Israel. God's grace is amazing, and it's on display in Exodus 18. Well, let us close in a word of prayer. Our Father in heaven, we thank you for your word and for its clarity, and we thank you for the wisdom that we find in a passage like this. Timeless wisdom, for sure. Things that truly are applicable to our own situation. And God, we do cry out to you for men in high places, that they would be able men, that they would be God-fearing men, that they would be men of truth and men that hate covetousness. Have mercy upon us in this land. Have mercy throughout this earth, Lord God Most High, and give grace and wisdom to your people. Help us to function properly and biblically in civil society and as well in our part in the church. And we ask this through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Well, any questions or comments? All right. Great. Delegate what?
Delegate
or relegate. Yeah, that's good.